This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Doing a little private business at work used to be fairly simple. It wasn't so easy for the boss to monitor what white-collar workers were doing, who they called, about what they were actually typing. When Patricia Dunn, the chairwoman of computer giant Hewlett-Packard, agreed to step aside earlier this week, it became clear that times have changed. Dunn came under fire for hiring private investigators to pry into the personal phone records of HP's board members and some journalists. She hired those investigators and provided them with the private information they needed to find out who was talking to the media. And while it's unusual to spy on your own board, for employees, this scenario turns out to be more common than we think. In the electronic age, employers have tons of information about their workers, not just phone numbers, addresses, and social security numbers, but also email traffic, phone records. Every time you swipe your magnetic badge in and out of the office, sometimes records of every key you touch on your computer and every website you visit. The question of whether or how they use this information worries privacy advocates. In the electronic age, have we ushered in a new type of office politics? Later, the United Nations Atomic Agency clashes with the U.S. House Intelligence Committee over a report on Iran's nuclear capabilities. But first, how much does your employer know about you and how much can they find out? If you have a question about the Hewlett-Packard case or the investigative techniques involved, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Richard Waters, West Coast editor for the Financial Times. He's with us now from studios in San Francisco. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hello, Neil. Nice to be here.
The HP case revolves around a particular tactic investigators used called pretexting. What's that?
Well, the worrying thing actually is we don't know whether this tactic is legal or illegal. It basically involves you or I going to a phone company, pretending to be somebody else and getting that person's phone records. You'd think that would be outright illegal because you're doing it by subterfuge. In fact, some states are passing laws to stop it. But, you know, in a lot of the country, it still seems to be legal.
So it's a gray area, well, certainly for private individuals to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in fact, it's a grey area for anyone to do it. I think private investigators under license have access to some information. They have access to databases where they can get some information about us. But even so, they themselves are in the same position as a private individual if it comes to calling up a phone company to try and access your private records. So really, I don't think anybody clearly has a right to it. The only question is, you know, how much is illegal? And I think the California Attorney General, who claims it clearly is going to have an interesting case on his hands to prove it.
In any case, it certainly gets easier to convince the phone company you're somebody else if you have that somebody else's social security number.
That's absolutely right. Well, very often you only need the last four digits. You don't need the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And those last four digits, there are police databases and other databases that certainly private investigators have access to. You and I, well, we all know the tools of identity theft are out there now, and a lot of people potentially do have access to those numbers. You'd hope that the phone companies would be a little more careful with who they're giving this information out to. And to me, I think one of the real eye-openers from the Hewlett-Packard case is just how careless those phone companies are.
Well, Patricia Dunn, the chairwoman, agreed to step aside, but she, how come? I mean, she says she wasn't aware of the techniques that these guys were using.
Yes, it's a very ugly compromise, I think, that has been struck in the HP boardroom this week. She's claiming that she simply instructed the HP legal department to go off and do the normal investigation that they would do if an employee was leaking information.
Round up the usual suspects, yeah.
Indeed. But she also claims, you know, that as in all things HP does, it should be legal and ethical. Well, it seems that the legal department hired the usual private investigator that HP has been using for years, and that person went off and did things that now look, well, certainly unethical, potentially illegal as well. Mm-hmm. And so Patricia Dunn, as the person who launched this whole thing, is taking the fall. I think it's interesting that she's actually staying until January as chairman, and she's staying after that as a director. And that's why I think it's a somewhat ugly compromise, because she's trying to, and HP is trying to project the fact that you know, that maybe she wasn't fully to blame for this. So she's taking the fall. I think, you know, if she's to blame and she's accepting responsibility, she should really be going at this point.
It could make for some interesting tension at some of those meetings next year. In any case, is this HP case all that unusual, or is it common for employers to hire private investigators to pry into the business of their employees, or in this case, their directors?
I think the one of the interesting things about this is you know how few of these cases make it out into the public domain. This one made it out because of warring egos on the HP board, and it was a bit like a family feud, and it just burst out into the open. So we got the whole facts. You know, talking to corporate lawyers and other investigators, of course, they all say this is incredibly rare, and they don't think it happens. But those of us, you know, who with a more cynical bent might think that this happens more than these people would like to admit. Mm-hmm. I mean, quite honestly, you know, it's very rare that it comes out into the public domain, but it's so easy to do, you have to assume other people are doing it.
The idea of chief executives, though, trying to tap the phone records of people, the phones of people, to find out who they're calling and why in order to stop leaks, didn't we learn anything from Richard Nixon about this?
Do you know, I think the big concerns now for workers, for anybody at work, is not so much their phone being tapped. There are much easier ways of finding out what you're doing and who you're talking to, and it's the PC and email. You know, you have to assume at work now that anything you write on your computer is now available to your employer should they want to see it. And that's not just on your corporate email system. You know, you could on your PC at work, you could go on to Gmail or Yahoo or one of the internet mail services. You have to assume, though, that anything that you're typing in can and will be seen if you're not careful.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We promise not to send any of your emails back to your employers. Let's talk with James. James is calling us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi. I work for a municipality here. And I'm a labor rep also. And where I work, we have working rules. There are 10 of them. And working rule number one is called falsification. And I can tell you as a labor rep, the people I represent can be fired sometimes on first offense for falsifying. So, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I am aware of the 10 commandments. And I have to wonder why, if this applies to me at my job, why people working in private entities don't get fired on first offense, and why, for that matter, it's not illegal for anyone to get information potentially about me other than my employer while I'm working. I know they can videotape me or whatever they want to do, and I'm fine with that, but seems to me that this ought to be illegal.
Richard Waters, I think the California Attorney General feels the same way.
He feels it is illegal. There is a law that very specifically makes it illegal to try and get people access to people's bank records or any financial records by pretending to be them, and so that's laid out and clear. The problem is that you get beyond bank records and nothing specific or very little specific is out there. There are a number of potential laws that do apply, and the Federal Trade Commission believes it's illegal. It is a murky area, and I suppose the good news about the HP case is that there are enough legislators now who've seen this, who are jumping up and down in Washington, that we can rest assured there will be law. It's taken a mess to bring it about.
Mm-hmm. The HP scandal highlighted. Thanks very much for the call, James. By the way,
thank you.
The HP scandal highlighted some of the legal gray areas around the tactics that private investigators use. We mentioned pretexting. Joining us now to talk more about this is Kevin Mitnick, a former hacker and private investigator, now an information security specialist and author of The Art of Deception. He's with us from the studios of member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Nice to talk to you.
Hey, good afternoon, Neil.
So have you ever pretext?
Sure did. I did when I was a hacker, and I did when I was a private investigator. Well, I actually worked under somebody else's license. And I made a lot of bad judgments in my life, and thank God this stuff happened like 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could have gotten into real trouble now.
Well, actually, there. You know, I was listening to the program, and there's a federal law, what they call the federal wire fraud statute, and that statute could be interpreted so broadly as to cover pretexting schemes as long as the target is something of value, like information.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you did it, is it hard?
No, it's really easy, and nothing has changed. I have friends that are private investigators today, and a lot of them simply work searching databases that are available via the internet for a fee, and they use social engineering in many of the cases to obtain information.
Well, what do you mean by social
financial
engineering?
I'm sorry?
What do you mean by social engineering?
Social engineering is a term in the information security field. It's actually synonymous with pretexting, but the term that PIs use is pretexting, and people in the information security space use social engineering.
Aha. Okay. Well, these are all euphemisms then.
I apologize. I should have clarified myself first.
That's okay. So what information do you need as a pretexter or a social engineer to wheedle information out of, say, the phone company?
Well, the phone company is quite easy, unfortunately. The attacker or the pretexter can go in one of two ways. The first way is posing as the customer. So if the attacker obtains, for example, the customer's last four digits of the Social Security number and the address and the name the account is in, or even the account number, it is simple to pose as the customer over the telephone. Looking up somebody's Social Security number takes about 30 seconds on the internet if you have access to the right databases. It's really not private information. The other way is pretexters go in, if they have knowledge of the phone company and how it works, they go in as what they call intercompany. And what intercompany means is when one department of the phone company calls another and has someone look up information on a computer. And typically those transactions aren't logged. When a customer calls in, for example, to like Singular, which is a cellular provider, mm-hmm. The telephone representative is supposed to log the call. So later on, if there's something untoward that had happened, they might be able to work it back.
All right. We're going to have to take a short break now. Richard Waters, we're going to let you go. Thanks so much for your time today.
All right. Thanks indeed.
Richard Waters is the West Coast editor for the Financial Times with us from the studios of radio station KGO in San Francisco. We'll continue with your questions for Kevin Mitnick when we get back from a short break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Call or email on any pretext. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the HP scandal over pretexting and other kinds of boardroom espionage and about the many tricks companies can use to snoop on their employees. Our guest is Kevin Mitnick, a former hacker, now an information security specialist and author of The Art of Deception. You're invited to join the discussion. Employees and employers, if you've been affected by electronic monitoring at work or if you've used it to get information about your workers, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And Kevin Mitnick, I guess one of the questions about this is that in the HP case, well, there was something valuable that was costing the company as this confidential information leaks out. There was a pretty good motive for the CEO to try to get to find out who was blabbing.
Yeah, I agree. You know, HP definitely has a right to protect their property interests, but I'm familiar that there's actually a California statute that prohibits pretexting utility companies, whether it's water, power, or telephone providers. But I suspect that that Ms. Dunn had not realized the techniques that are used, because typically private investigators don't explain to their clients, this is how we're going to get the information. They simply get it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is unclear whether she really knew what the techniques were in this case.
And probably unclear as to whether she wanted to know, but I guess that's another issue we'd have to
that's
get into.
That's plausible deniability. Look at the Anthony Pelicano case where Mr. Pelicano was allegedly wiretapping individuals for law firms.
Yeah, this
down
in Los
Angeles.
I mean,
that was a big case.
Yeah. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Harvey. Harvey calling us from Oakland.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, my question is, if someone goes and pretexts me, or if I call myself, you know, don't have to pretext, can I get from the phone company any information that is actually printed on my phone bill, like incoming calls that would appear on my caller ID?
Yes. Yes, you can. The phone company, if it's a cellular phone company, they actually keep track of incoming calls for airtime. But another technique...
Standard landline phone company, you know, SBC, it's now called.
Only if you have an 800 number. But if you have a regular, what they call POTS number, plain ordinary telephone service, it usually doesn't log incoming calls. You could have something log your caller ID information.
They don't keep a record of it, you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you.
So the lower tech you go might be an advantage in certain circumstances.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Harvey. Yeah.
There's another technique that pretexters could use, and that's caller ID spoofing. That's where you can spoof your caller ID, which means forge it, and call one of these telecommunications providers. So when the telephone rep sees that you're calling, it appears that you're calling from the actual customer's telephone number. And that way the pretexter or social engineer is able to gain trust and credibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That would be useful in any number of contexts, not just phone companies.
What the bottom line is you're, we don't have privacy, get over it. That's what Scott McNeely said. What has to be done is these companies need to be trained or they need to train their people on how to treat sensitive information. And maybe the government has to step in and start regulating this area.
Mm-hmm. Let's get Larry on the line. Larry's with us from, where is this, Len Haven in Florida. Is that right?
That's correct.
Go ahead, please.
Isn't an investigator using little tidbits of info to pretend they're me to gain access to even more sensitive info about me? Isn't that just plain old identity theft?
It's not identity theft. It's identity theft, I think, is where someone actually steals your identity, but they are posing as you. They're using your mother's maiden name, your social security number, your date of birth, your driver's license number to pretend to be you to get information. And while we know it's unethical and immoral, the question is if you're in the state of Florida, for example, is it illegal?
What is the difference?
What's the difference?
Well, identity theft is where a criminal actually steals your identity and opens extensions of credit, like they obtain a credit card in your name, they obtain a driver's license in your name, and they defraud you. Somebody just posing as you over the telephone or an email to get your personal information, I don't characterize that as identity theft.
Okay.
All right, Larry.
But it's definitely illegal in some respects, but I think it's termed something differently.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, Kevin, you were a genius back when you were up and running, buddy.
Okay,
take it easy.
I'm not sure genius is quite the word you would use for yourself these days. You mentioned some errors of judgment.
Oh, definitely errors of judgment. That is definitely the truth.
If those making errors of judgment were using these kinds of techniques, obviously you can it's credit card companies. It's not just the phone company.
Oh, exactly. When I was a PI, typically other PIs in the office, they would target banks. They would target credit card companies. For example, if they have a person that's under surveillance and they want to know where they had been, a credit card statement is a gold mine. They'd also run credit reports like a TRW, TransUnion, or it's actually Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion to get, the different banks that people bank at, different account numbers. And even from that, they would get little bits of data so they could pretend to be that person. They'd target utility companies, not just the phone company, but electric company, the water company. They'd look for property records, which are pretty much an open book. And any type of information, depending on the type of investigation, a lot of PI firms do what they call asset investigation. So a law firm wants to sue a company or they want to sue an individual. Well, they want to see what type of assets that company or individual has before spending the money. So they'll typically go out and hire a PI firm to do an asset investigation. And while some of them may work ethically by just searching databases that are available on the internet, there is plenty of them that use social engineering or pretexting to get additional information for their clients.
Is this, you've talked about ethically and morally wrong, is it always bad?
Well, I'll tell you, you make a decision here. Many years ago, when I was a PI, worked for a PI, and I used pretexting, a father kidnapped a child, his child, and left the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a particular predetermined time—
Very bitter divorce proceedings, custody battles?
Yes. I don't know the actual details. I just know there was a kidnapping involved, and the father took the kid, and the kid and the father were not to be found.
Okay. So
the father called the mother at a payphone in Santa Monica, California, at a particular time and date. The PI firm I was working for needed to obtain the phone number that called that payphone at a particular time. Apparently, to go through the legal process, you'd have to get justice involved, you'd have to issue subpoenas, and by the time it went through all that paperwork, the data would be worthless. So I was actually hired to go in to find out what phone number called that payphone at a particular time, and I did obtain the information, and it was all through social engineering or pretexting the telephone company because I knew how the telephone company worked so well. And I look at, well, yeah, at the time I was doing this, it wasn't illegal. There was no law against it. But was it immoral? Was it ethical? Yeah, it was because I was posing as somebody else. But at the same time, I looked at, well, it's going to help this mother hopefully recover her child. So I was looking at also there was a benefit to it at that time. But then again, at that time, I was a hacker and I used a lot of bad judgment. So today I live in a different world than I did back then.
You're talking about what you did as a private individual and the gray areas, but what about the police, the municipal, county, state, or federal authorities? They do have to play by the rules.
Yeah, well, sometimes. I mean, sometimes you hear about them breaking the rules. They're supposed to play by the rules, but the federal and state and local law enforcement, they go through a suspect's trash. They have special numbers. They call at these utility companies to get information. A lot of these utility companies, even though it may require a subpoena, will always cooperate with law enforcement. And what a lot of PIs do is they befriend people in law enforcement or they've been in law enforcement before. And what they do is they get information of how to get this information through a law enforcement channel. For example, at the Department of Department of Water and Power in Los Angeles, they have a thing called a special desk that only law enforcement is supposed to call. So if you have a name and you have the number to call, then they trust that you're law enforcement and they'll simply give you any information that you request. Now, this was like 10, 15 years ago. I don't know if it's changed today. Well, a lot of PIs that have buddies in law enforcement get these tools and they use it, you know, in their own business.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Omar. Omar is calling us from Miami.
Yes, thanks for taking my phone call. I just wanted to give a comment based on my personal experience from my phone records being accessed by, some girlfriends of mine. You can put a password other than your mother's maiden name or, you know, something that nobody knows but you on any of your credit card records, you know, phone records, and nobody will be able to access it. You know, you have to come up with that password in addition to your social security and your mother's maiden name for somebody to get any information about you. And I think some actually phone companies now, cell companies I'm talking about, even if you tried to access it online, you would have to put in that password in for you to get the record.
Kevin Mitnick, is he right?
That's true. It does help, but that only helps if the social engineer or pretexter is calling pretending to be you, the customer. Now, if the pretexter knows the cell phone companies or the local phone companies and they're able to impersonate a phone company employee and call a colleague, then usually what will happen is that colleague or that other phone company employee will look up the password and give the password to a particular customer to whom they think is another phone company employee.
Mm-hmm.
It happens all the time with, for example, the Paris Hilton hack allegedly happened where a social engineer or actually a hacker called up a T-Mobile like retail outlet, pretended to be another T-Mobile where they were having computer problems and actually had her look up her account information and password. And it didn't matter because the T-Mobile store thought it was another T-Mobile store calling.
Mm-hmm.
So it does make it's a great idea. Definitely do never use your mother's maiden name, never use your driver's license number, never use your social security number. All those pieces of information, even your mother's maiden name, so many people use it. You can go on the internet, and if you were born in California, Kentucky, or Texas, anybody could look up your birth record and find out your mother's maiden name. So it's really important not to use those pieces of non-public personal identifying information as a means of proving that you are who you say you are.
Omar, I have to ask, did your girlfriend get access to your records?
Well, before she did, and that's how I actually learned that I can put a different password other than, in addition to everything I have, that will stop her from getting my phone records, because she used to make her voice a little thicker than normal and just, she knows all my information to pretend that she's me and just get my phone records and see who I was talking to.
Mm-hmm. Did she have reason for suspicion?
Well, that's a whole different story.
All right, Omar. Maybe
right,
that's
thank
you. Thanks very much for the call.
No problem.
Neil, there's also another scary thing is there's a company in Thailand that sells a piece of software supposedly to watch like your spouse or your girlfriend, and you put the software in their cell phone and it monitors everything they do, their location, every SMS message that they send and receive. You could log onto the website and recover it. And this software is sold on the internet for $49. So this is actually where it's becoming more sophisticated, where people are actually able to monitor the content of phone calls, the content of SMS messages, and keep a log of it for $50.
Well, Kevin Mitnick.
It's scary.
Yeah, it's scary. And with the GPS, they have an actual track of where you were. Kevin Mitnick, thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Nice to talk to you. Kevin Mitnick, an information security specialist, author of The Art of Deception. He joined us today from the studios of member station KNPR in Las Vegas. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Private investigators in the HP case relied on personal information from the company to get access to other private records. And although that story involves a board of directors, it has put a spotlight on exactly how much information companies typically have about their employees. Joining us to talk a bit more about privacy in the workplace is Ann Fisher, a senior writer at Fortune magazine and the Ask Annie columnist at CNNMoney.com. She's with us from her home in Sullivan County in New York. Good to speak with you today.
Hello, Neil. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. In the letters you get for your column, how concerned are workers about the information that employers may have about them?
Well, I think that workers are very concerned, and I think that they have pretty good reason to be, actually, because, as we've been discussing here today, your employer really does have a lot of access to information about what you do on a minute-by-minute basis during the day. And, you know, sometimes people are kind of shocked. Excuse me, I've got my first cold of the winter already. Do you believe it? People are kind of shocked to realize that your employer has every right to monitor your email and your phone use and anything else that you might be doing that involves equipment that belongs to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes people get a little bit misled by the fact that you have this computer on your desk and you're using it all the time, and so it sort of feels like yours, but it's not yours. It belongs to your employer. And some really high proportion of companies do at least some spot monitoring of people's email use and also internet surfing. I can't give you an exact percentage because I've seen different ones. It's anywhere from 90% to 99% of companies do some kind of monitoring. And so you really have to have the idea sort of implanted firmly in your mind that there is no expectation of privacy. Mm-hmm. You really, when you're at your desk and you're using your employer's equipment, you really should use it as if every single thing you were doing was going to be broadcast, to the entire world, because it might be. I mean, we all remember those wonderfully entertaining emails in the Microsoft antitrust case where the case against Microsoft was built almost entirely on emails, and that happened to a couple of Wall Street firms also.
Coming up in the Jack Abramoff investigation, too. Yeah.
There you go. So, your employer, if you look at situations like that where things do get used as evidence in court cases, clearly your employer does have an interest in knowing what you're doing, what you're emailing to people. So that's why they kind of get nervous and they do keep an eye on it.
And probably the argument that you're trying to design a better version of Battleship for your company, it's not going to fly.
Not unless you work for the company that makes Battleship. And how many of us are that lucky, really?
Yeah. Let's talk with Peter. Peter's calling us from Newton, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi. I worked for a company as a consultant. I've been working for 18 years. I'll go into a company, help fix things, and then leave.
Mm-hmm.
This company in particular, they gave me an office so that I could work on site, a computer and so forth. My work was very good, and they were so happy they offered me a full-time job. And it was $130,000 a year and 100,000 shares of stock. If they went public, I would make a great deal. I needed to contact a lawyer. I did so. We emailed back and forth a few times. I went from being this great person to the VP of marketing was yelling at me and yelling
They intercepted your emails, yeah.
I just couldn't understand how the week before I'd been made this job offer, and now this week I can't do anything right, and she's yelling and yelling. So finally, like about maybe 8 or 9 days later, I was called down to see the CEO. He says, you have two choices. You can resign or be fired.
Peter, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Ugly choices. Thanks very much for the call. More on this after the break. This is NPR News. Right now we're talking about high-tech office snooping with Ann Fisher. She's a senior writer at Fortune and writes the Ask Annie column at cnnmoney.com. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, or you can send us an email, talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Doug. Doug's calling us from Dayton, Ohio.
Hey, Neil.
Hi.
I sit at a computer all day, most of the week. And I know from office gossip that our IT guy can monitor what we're doing. I know that he monitors our email, inter-office email, for example. But I want to know, is there a way, if I'm sitting in my computer, is there a way I can tell what exactly he is monitoring or what access they have? Is there anything I can pull up on my computer that would give me that kind of information? Or should I just assume that they can see everything, even email from an internet source? For example.
Ann Fisher?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, there's really no software available that that would tell you what or when this IT guy is watching what you're doing. If I were you, I would just, to be on the safe side, assume that he can see everything you're doing and just assume that you actually have no privacy whatsoever. There may be software available that would sort of clue you into when he's watching or not watching, but if there is, I'm not aware of it. And, probably it would just give you a false sense of security anyway, because these things evolve so quickly that, for every new technological advance that comes out, somebody, figures out a way around it, and then you've got to get more sophisticated still. So I would just assume you have no privacy. And, a lot of companies, even though they know that people do a certain amount of internet surfing that's not really job-related, maybe you go to Sears.com and check out the end-of-season lawnmower sale or something. I don't think most companies really get too exercised about that because, they realize that people need a 5-minute break in their routine every once in a while. It's really the people who are chronic abusers of the system who end up getting in trouble, spending half the day at some gambling website or something. Most companies, it's not that they want you to never use your computer for anything not work-related. It's just it makes them a little bit uneasy, what could happen to productivity. You've got a few people who get carried away, and that's really why most of this monitoring goes on. It's very easy to get a little bit paranoid, though, because there's something creepy about the realization that someone's watching everything you're doing.
Right.
What you're doing is perfectly innocent. I don't know. I think it's sort of hardwired in us to not want to be watched so closely. At least that's how I feel about it.
Thanks,
yeah,
Doug.
I do banking online like a lot of people do, and I just want to know, can he see all my passwords and all my accounts and everything else?
I don't think so. No. I don't think that the monitoring software that's available now goes to that level of detail. I mean, he may be able to see, you're logging into bankofamerica.com. Beyond that, no, I don't think he can see what your bank account numbers are or anything like that.
The camera over your shoulder might be able to, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doug, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Brian. Brian's with us from Salem, Oregon.
Yes. I work for a company, actually a technological computer firm. And in my daily job, I have to go out and call on customers and stuff. And I am provided, you know, with a cell phone and computer and all that stuff. And I, the division between my personal life and my business life is becoming grayer and grayer by quite a few of my friends. And where do we call the, you know, that line, and where do we make that distinction between getting a phone call on my cell phone or an email from my girlfriend or you know, my kids, and what's work and what's business, and what does my employer have the right to watch, even when I'm like have a computer at home and I'm using my personal computer that he provides services or for on that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's a good question, because this whole area, you know, this is a new frontier, and we really don't have standards in place for this. And I think employers are struggling with it too, because, you know, as you say, if you're basically on call 24/7, does that mean you have no privacy 24/7? I mean, that doesn't seem right. That's very 1984. So, you know, I think that the way that I've seen some people resolve this dilemma is to get a personal cell phone or a BlackBerry or whatever, Palm Pilot, and use your personal, you know, try to keep it separate. Use your personal cell phone for personal business, your work phone for work business, and just keep it as separate as you can.
And let me ask you a question. Do you carry two cell phones?
No, but I know people who do. I know people who do. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know. Most people are already carrying so much stuff. But it's, you know,
cell phones, laptops, and
yeah, exactly. It's it's heavy enough to begin with. Duplicating it, it's going to get you take you forever to get through the airport.
I'm not sure that your employer is really monitoring your cell phone that much anyway. You know, simply because I don't think they have the resources to monitor phone calls, you know, to the extent where they would, where that would really be too much.
It's as simple as a log onto a website. You see the whole call log for the last year that I've had my cell phone. You can see absolutely every single incoming and outgoing phone number, and if there's caller ID information, that too.
Do you have some reason to believe that they are monitoring your phone calls, or you're just saying hypothetically they could be?
No, hypothetically, I don't have any personal reason to believe so, but I know quite a few people that do. I have several of my friends that are in the technology industry and in sales like I am, and always, you know, some of the questions is, you know, where does the personal and the business life, where's that line get drawn? Because quite often, you know, you're going through the airport, on the road, flying and stuff like that. How can we carry three or four different devices for our personal and four or five devices for work? Realistically, it gets marred down to one or two devices for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's paid for by the employer or paid for by me. I mean, I have my own personal laptop, but I have software and stuff on that computer that my employer has paid for. You know, so does he have the right then to have access to my computer because he's got to protect his rights on that software and the services in there? Or is it my laptop? Where does that line?
These are questions of the 21st century, Brian. Thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
I'm not sure that there are answers to this, Ann Fisher.
No, I don't think there are yet, but I think we're going to discover them over the next decade or so.
Hope you feel better. Hope the cold improves.
Thank you.
Ann Fisher joining us by phone from her home in Sullivan County, New York. She's a senior writer at Fortune Magazine and the Ask Annie columnist at CNNMoney.com. When we come back, the battle between the IAEA and the House Intelligence Committee.